The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
There is no doubt we face a profound economic challenge. We now need stability and unity. I pledge that I will serve you with integrity and humility.
The most important objective for our country right now is stability. Governments cannot eliminate volatility in markets.
You're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Ewan Potts.
And I'm Stephen Carroll. Welcome to the show. Today we have a smorgasbord, a platter of Bloomberg experts on the show today. We're going to talk about strikes. We're going to talk about the latest on wind power. We're going to talk about a new call about tax avoidance. And we're going to talk about the Bloomberg Breakfast Index. But first, Ewan, this being Bloomberg, we can't not mention the Bank of England today.
Stephen, I would like to have a small rant.
Oh, just a small one. That's a relief.
Yes. It's about the coverage of interest rates in the media, the mainstream media. I guess that's us.
Us,
and
yeah.
People like us. It is almost always portrayed as a really bad thing, a terrible thing. Interest rates are going up. It's going to cause pain for households, pain for families. And of course, it does cause pain for people with mortgages. And people have big mortgages. And often when interest rates go up, it means a large increase in people's mortgages. So it can be very painful for some people. But most people don't have mortgages. And a lot of people, millions of people, particularly older people, rely on their savings. And for 10 years, they have had zero return on their savings. And suddenly, interest rates are going up. And that is a very positive thing for them. And funnily enough, a little survey from the Bank of England is published today, which is backing up my rant. They found that just 30% of Brits say they would personally benefit from interest rates going down. That is about the same proportion, 27%. Who would benefit from them going up. So actually, the proportions are pretty finely balanced. So I do think we need to be a little bit careful when we talk about the horrors of rising interest rates.
True. I think the other side of this, of course, is that for those people that it is going up for, it's quite a lot. The Bank of England saying the typical payment's going to increase by up to £250, which could cause financial difficulties, the Bank of England says, for 220 households. So there's, you know, as always, it's a more complex story than perhaps on first sight.
220,000 households.
220,000 households, yes.
Yes, I think for those that are affected, it is very serious. But the numbers affected, actually, I think are quite small.
Okay, point duly noted. Rant over. Ewan Potts, thank you very much. Let's turn, though, to the latest strikes. Of course, this has been a week where we've seen strikes already in the railway sector and from postal workers. Today, it is nurses beginning their historic round of strikes. Britain facing the prospect of worsening industrial unrest extending into next year.
Yeah, the Royal College of Nursing says that as many as 100,000 staff are taking part in today's walkouts across England, Wales and Northern Ireland in protest over a below inflation pay offer. More strikes planned for December 20th next week. Well, let's get the thoughts of our UK business editor, Julian Harris. Julian, thanks for joining us in the studio today. Where does all this leave patients? What's the effect been on the NHS?
Well, we're going to see how that plays out. This is, as you said, the first of two nurses' strikes today and then again on Tuesday next week. And this is pretty unprecedented. We've had nurses' strikes before, but they've tended to be quite isolated. This is the first one where we've had such a wide range across. It's England, Wales and Northern Ireland as well. I think what's going to happen, we've already had a row between NHS bosses and the nursing unions over how this could affect patients. So nurses have said that they are covering kind of very crucial and emergency procedures. Some NHS bosses have said, well, actually, some chemotherapy has already had to be postponed. And I mean, I think the kind of horrible truth is through nurses' strikes and the ambulance workers as well, which we've also got coming up, we're going to have cases where people are suffering and that is put down to the strike. It might then be debatable whether it was because of the strike or not, because of course the NHS has not been in a great place in general, but that debate certainly is going to get heightened and more emotive as well.
So we have two dates, one of which is today for nurses' strikes. Could there be more next year?
I think so, yeah, simply because there is such a big gap between where the nurses' union currently is and where the government is. The government is really sticking to its line that it's had an independent recommendation for a pay increase, that it previously increased nurses' pay when other workers didn't get it, and that's that, and that they're refusing to budge. And the nurses are saying, well, you have to come and talk to us about pay, and if you don't, there are reports this morning that then they're just going to announce fresh dates next week into the new year. And we've been talking to some union reps on the picket lines this morning, and they've repeated that to us and said they expect there to be more to come.
Be interesting to see how this plays out in the court of public opinion. I saw the survey earlier this week that showed that nurses have more support than any other group for their strike. And I wonder how, when people start to see things being cancelled in the NHS, if that support will start to change a little. Looking more widely, who else is on strike at the moment? This could take some time to go through this list.
Yeah, this is going to be a list. we are in a really in the midst of it now. So this is the worst part, we should say. There's also Royal Mail today. So lots of packages won't be arriving in time for Christmas, and that's had a knock-on effect on other couriers as well. And then the train strikes are back on tomorrow, which of course affects passengers, and Saturday as well, and also some freight services potentially. We've got bus drivers, some Eurostar ones have been suspended, so hopefully that gets resolved, that's good. We've also got passport control, and then baggage handlers at Heathrow have just announced that they're going to go ahead with their strikes and have new ones as well. So it's quite wide ranging. In terms of public support, it will be interesting. We've seen with train drivers that their support has fallen in the last couple of months. And I think this is important, train drivers in general have far less sympathy among the public than nurses do. And there has been very much this embedded view across society for a long time that nurses are underpaid and underappreciated. So it's going to become a very fiery issue, as I say, for certain. But I wouldn't quite bet on public opinion shifting radically.
What's been the effect of all of this on businesses and on the city?
It's funny because, of course, post-COVID, a lot of businesses are far more relaxed about the effect of certainly transport strikes. So we've had reports showing that numbers in the city, people coming to work, is very low. There are estimates about 1 in 5 desks being filled in the city, whereas just before all this happened, numbers had got really a lot higher in a post-COVID sense. And we were seeing lots and lots more people coming back to the office in the middle of the week. But that's really plummeted this week. But those businesses, and I'm sure the workers as well, many of them just don't care. They can still work from home and it's all fine. Where it's really being felt is the hospitality and retail businesses in town centres, where footfall in bars, pubs, restaurants and shops is heavily down, and they're really taking a hit.
Yeah, rotten time of year if that's to be happening for the hospitality trade. Thanks so much for joining us. That is our UK business editor and strikes czar, Julian Harris.
Now, if you're a regular listener to the podcast, you'll know we enjoy, or rather revel, in talking a lot about the cost of living crisis and the various details of it. Our next guest is bringing home the bacon, but on this subject. Katie Linsell is our UK retail reporter. Katie, you have been writing up the latest version of the Bloomberg Breakfast Index. Tell us more about the idea behind this and exactly what it is.
Hi, good morning. Yeah, so we're looking at basically the cost of all the key ingredients that go into the English breakfast, the sort of full fry up, and using that as a way to look each month at how the cost of food and drinks has increased. So we use ONS data to look at that and the CPI data that we get out every month. And in this case, we've seen that the price of the English breakfast has actually increased by more than the general ONS figure for food and drinks. So it was a 16.4% increase for the wider ONS figure. And then we saw that this precise basket of goods actually increased more than 21% year on year. So yeah, it is a kind of stark image for the consumer of how prices are rising on their breakfast table.
And Katie, talk us through some of the components of your breakfast index. What has gone up by the most shocking percentages over the past year?
Yeah, so it's really the sort of staples, the basic goods that a lot of people are going to be buying. And I think that's why we're seeing this basket increase so much more than the broader measure. So milk is the biggest increase. That's almost 50% up year on year. Butter is 30%. So that's the next biggest riser. And then eggs. And of course, we have seen with eggs that, you know, they've hit the headlines a lot over the past month or so, because many supermarkets had to sort of ration buying of eggs. We had bird flu, a new outbreak of bird flu, and that has meant that there's more and more culling of chickens, and so less eggs available. But yes, it's those basics that are really rising the most.
Katie, what in terms of effects of this? I mean, it's a very good illustration of how much prices have gone up in the UK. But what other changes are we seeing more broadly in the UK as a result of the increased cost of these basics?
So people are really shopping around. They're also going, when they go to supermarkets, they're also buying more sort of own label goods. So rather than buying sort of branded milk or branded bread, they'll be buying their supermarket's own brand, which tends to be a bit cheaper. And then that also focuses their mind on, you know, am I going to stick with this supermarket that I've been going to for months or years? Or am I going to try out some of the cheaper options? So we've seen more and more shoppers go to the German discounters, Aldi and Lidl. They've really been major winners through this environment. Both have gained market share. In the case of Aldi, it actually now sits as the fourth biggest UK supermarket. So it knocked Morrison's off that spot in September. So yeah, a lot of movement by shoppers in reaction to this.
Katie, thanks so much for joining us today. That's Katie Linsell, our UK retail reporter and compiler of the Bloomberg Breakfast Index. As Katie says, a lot of the staples going up in price. Interesting that eggs and milk, some of the worst affected, butter as well. But do check that out on the Bloomberg Terminal and the Bloomberg website.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. the lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, is the tax system allowing people to use their pension pots to avoid inheritance tax? That is the finding of a new report today from the Institute for Fiscal Studies.
The IFS wants the government to change the law to end what it calls a bizarre situation. Bloomberg's finance reporter Tom Metcalfe joins us now for more. Tom, to quote the OMC song, how bizarre.
Yeah, no, definitely. It was one of those reports you read and you start to lean forward a bit more. It's certainly an arrangement I wasn't aware of, and I suspect it's sort of definitely still on the margins. And actually, the IFS are getting this report out there in a bid to change it. So this sort of loophole may not be around for long. But effectively, if you have enough money that you don't need to use your pension, what they're saying is some very wealthy people are effectively funding their retirement through other assets, and then when they die, as long as they do that before 75, which is a little bit of a catch for this problem, with this system even, then they get to hand that off without inheritance tax.
It's quite a clever wheeze, isn't it? I was interested to read the story because I hadn't heard of this, and not being particularly rich, I haven't been planning my, passing on huge piles of cash. How many people do we think are doing this? How widespread do we think it is?
Yeah, so the report says right now there's probably not huge amounts of money moving through the system, but what it says is, if this is allowed to continue, what they expect is something like about £2 billion of tax a year would be sort of being missed by the HMRC. So what they're saying is, why don't you tax this and use that money to reduce taxes elsewhere and or, help the sort of public spending burden, or at least just align it so, kind of everyone can benefit.
Is there an advantage to keeping the system the way it is? Is there a reason that the system was developed, do we know?
I think it's just, classic tax system, right? Unintended consequences. So, no, I don't think that it was ever intended to sort of be a
sort of, as you say, quite well put, a wheeze to get around it. But that's how sort of some sharp-eyed wealth managers are starting to use it.
Put £2 billion in a bit of context for us. I mean, that's hardly a game-changing amount of money, is it, for the government? But it would be useful, perhaps, in removing some taxes or increasing some spending.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think it's sort of, in the context of all inheritance tax, that's a pretty big chunk. So sort of looking at kind of significant percentage of that. But yes, obviously, when you've got, a government deeply in debt, trying to sort of find ways to manage, hundreds of billions of pounds of spend every year, probably won't massively change the dial. But it's one of those things where it's an easy fix, and as I say, it kind of just benefits the wealthy. So I suspect you'll see these reforms come through pretty quickly.
Yeah, it's interesting because, of course, we've had so much focus politically on the non-dom status and how Labour is using that as a stick to beat the government with. Keir Starmer brought it up again in Prime Minister's Questions yesterday. You can imagine this is an issue that will very quickly become political as well.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's one of those things where perhaps the real life impact is certainly for now, pretty minimal, but it definitely will capture people's minds. And I was just talking to a few colleagues, and that's the death tax, as some people calls it, really does sort of get people on both sides of the political aisle really engaged. Some people will say, hey, we're getting taxed so many times, all of this has been taxed once, and now the government are looking for perhaps going to look at a way of shutting off his loophole, which is appealing to some at least.
Tom, thanks so much. That's Tom Metcalfe, our finance reporter, joining us in the studio.
We're now several days into the cold snap that's driven up demand for power here in the UK. Spot prices hit that record high on Monday. Part of the problem is what's known as a dunkelflaut, which is not a word I have to say I was familiar with until this week.
Goodness. Well, our renewable energy reporter, Will Mathis, is here to explain, hopefully. Will, what is this?
So, dunkelflaut is a German term
for correcting my pronunciation.
The kind of weather we're having this week, which is cold and still for a number of days. So it's not just like, a couple hours when the wind's not blowing, but it's, a days long period. And this whole week, basically, it's been freezing cold and the wind has been really not there, which is nice when you're walking down the street and you don't get really cold wind in your face, but it's terrible for power production. So we're really relying mostly on gas here in the UK for our electricity.
Because I remember discussing this back in the heady days of summer when the idea of freezing weather seemed a very long way off. And the National Grid, it's a key job of theirs is to plan for these kind of things, isn't it? They said they were planning for when there's a really cold snap and the wind doesn't blow. And that is exactly this week, isn't it? I think we probably didn't think it was going to happen at the beginning of December because it's not normally that cold this time of year. But so far, the lights haven't gone off, have they? What have the grid been doing to make sure that doesn't happen? And can we give them a little sort of pat on the back for doing a good job?
Yeah, I mean, the lights haven't gone off. And, this is the worst-case weather scenario. But to get to a blackout kind of scenario, you'd have to pair the worst-case weather scenario with also a worst-case infrastructure scenario, and that hasn't happened. So this week we've been importing tons of power from the continent, which is vital, and it's what the system is designed to do. The grid had said that, there could be shortfalls if for some reason the interconnectors were not flowing, if they couldn't get power from Europe when they needed it, and they have. And there's also been some good news in France, where the nuclear fleet has been, in the summer, less than half of all of France's nuclear plants were online at all. And they've gotten that number up to a bit over 2/3 now. It's trending in the right direction. They're still really behind schedule with completing repairs. But more French nuclear plants have been online and able to send power to other parts of Europe and the UK where it's been really needed. So that's how we've avoided the worst.
We had that peak in power prices for 5 p.m. on Monday was this moment we were told that the spot price had reached this record high. This kind of later stage into the week, are we still looking at very high prices for power?
We are looking at very high prices for power. And it's important to realize that these record high prices we're talking about are a very small portion of all electricity. These are half-hour intraday prices. This is where the grid gets, like, you know, the last bit of power to make sure they have enough supply to meet demand. But it's not what, you know, it will affect bills ultimately, but not that much. This isn't like how much you're paying for all of your electricity at 5 p.m. It's just this very small piece of a much larger puzzle.
Yeah, turn off your appliances in that early evening peak if possible.
This is now what we're being finally told in the UK, is the campaign's finally being rolled out, telling people to reduce consumption, something that's been done for months and months in other parts of Europe.
I think it's going to be rolled out next month, isn't it, as you say? But in Europe, they've been doing it since summer.
I mean, they were talking about it. I think the first mention of the hilarious French expression energy sobriety was in June, maybe, and the campaign was actually rolled out, like full-on campaign rolled out, from September. So this is a message that was being said very clearly in countries like France from, you know, early summer, and here it's taken until now to get people to do it. And it's something that's conversation when I speak to my friends in France and other parts of Europe as well, that's a conversation that everyone's having about, oh, we'll make sure to switch off temperatures, things like that, temperatures in offices being turned down, European buildings, for example, all of the European Commission buildings, they've turned down the thermostats so that they're not using as much power. So it's been interesting to see that conversation's finally shifting and being had here in the UK as well.
Yes, and it seems that broadly we've done very little on that front. I wanted to change the subject slightly to something you've written about for the Bloomberg Terminal today. That's changes to regulations so that we get more wind power. Just explain what's happening with that.
Yeah, so basically the regulator Ofgem has changed some rules to speed up investment in the electric grid, which is vital for actually getting the renewable power that wind farms generate to the people who need to use it. And the big challenge there is that the wind resources are really far away. They're out in the North Sea or they're up in Scotland. And to get them to London and the surrounding areas where most people in the country live, you need a lot of cables. And if you want to very quickly ramp up wind power, it's relatively straightforward to build the wind farms, but it's much more complicated to build enough transmission. And if you don't, then it doesn't really matter how many wind farms you build, because you won't be able to use all of that electricity. So this is a pretty important change, and shows that the regulators are listening to government targets as they get bigger, and that they're making changes to actually make those targets into reality.
The current goal here in the UK is 50 gigawatts of wind farms by 2030. Is that achievable?
Technically.
Right.
it's ambitious.
I sense doubt from you, Will.
Well, you know, our colleagues at Bloomberg NEF who forecast these things don't think we're on track to get there. It's going to be challenging. There are going to be supply chain issues. There's regulation and permitting issues. Whether we get there in 2030 is going to be difficult, but even if we're a bit late, you know, the changes can be made to make this happen. And if you set a target, you know, even if you're late, if you do get there, that's, you know, important for emissions and for helping reduce the impact on the climate.
Better late than never, essentially. Okay, Will Mathis, our renewable energy reporter, thank you very much for joining us to talk us through all of the various aspects of that story. Ewan, you've been looking ahead to some events coming up later.
Yeah, in the House of Commons today, international trade questions. Then Penny Mordaunt, the Leader of the Commons, will present the weekly business statement, barring any urgent questions. And then also be a backbench motion on prepayment fuel meters, carrying on with that subject. And importantly, a general debate on the West Coast Main Line, which I think will pertain to the rotten performance, it is said by many people, of Avanti.
I will not let you have another rant, Ewan.
Oh, that's another one
of your favourite subjects.
We'll take that for another day.
That is it from us for today. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe or give it 5 stars so other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you usually listen.
This episode was produced by James Wilcock and Marie-Faul Hussain. I'm Ewan Potts.
And I'm Stephen Carroll. We'll be back with more tomorrow. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you love Elon Musk? Do you hate Elon Musk? Do you have no idea what to think about Elon Musk? Then we have just the show for you.
He's become even more larger than life.
Buying Twitter doesn't get us closer to Mars.
They are like really close to the edge of like everything falling apart.
Like, oh, Elon, I volunteer, put a chip in my brain.
Each week on this podcast, we'll break down, analyze, and debate the most important stories on Musk and his empire.
It's all one big universe. You just work for Elon Inc.
From Bloomberg Businessweek, this is Elon Inc. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.